Our first speaker this morning is Lance Price, and I'm delighted to welcome Lance to Enniskillen. I remember Lance as a BBC journalist back in the 1980s for BBC Northern Ireland, based in Belfast. And I think it's fair to say, Lance, that after that, your career in the media took a slightly different direction, becoming special advisor to Prime Minister Tony Blair. He hastens to add that he did not advise him on Iraq. But I think with the controversy at the moment to do with the Murdoch empire and involvement in government and so on, I think there's no better person, better placed than Lance, who is the author of The Spin Doctor's Diary, which will be extremely interesting from my perspective and from yours as well. Lance told me last night that he used to come to Fermanagh to go potholing, which strikes me as only marginally less dangerous than being deputy to Alistair Campbell. So I suppose welcome back to Fermanagh, Lance, and we look forward to hearing from you.
Denzel, thank you very much. It really is a great pleasure to come back. The mid to late 1980s, when I was a reporter here, seems like a very, very long time ago. And it's actually the first time we've been back to Enniskillen since I covered the dreadful bombing in 1987. And obviously, Enniskillen's changed a lot, Fermanagh's changed a lot, Northern Ireland's changed a lot since then. And I've done my best to keep abreast of those changes, but from a distance. I've popped back occasionally when I've been invited to do so. But the rest of my career since then, some of which Denzel's described to you, has been on the national stage in one form, one form or another. My career with the BBC carried on for about 17 years, I then, for a short period of time, went to work. Relatively short period of time, went to work for Tony Blair in Downing Street in his first term as Prime Minister. And so, for the first chunk of my career, the first career I had, all views had to be treated with equal respect and balance, and my own views weren't allowed to count for anything. In the second career I had, only one person's views counted for anything at all, and they were the views of the Prime Minister, Tony Blair, never mind the Cabinet or anybody else in the Labour Party or anybody else anywhere else. So it was only after that, in 2001, when I stopped working for Tony Blair, that finally I had my independence and my freedom, and I was able to speak my own mind about things. But Nick did warn me last night. He said, you're there as the punch ball, basically. You're a self-confessed former spin doctor, so they're obviously going to beat you up. So I'm glad that we've got a nice informal setting for the conversation, which I think is exactly the way to go about it. It's nice to build up some sort of cozy empathy. Here am I desperately trying to get on your side. You can see that, but there may be some of you sitting there thinking, what on earth is he doing sitting up there talking to us about the media and ethics? And there you are, right from the beginning, we have something in common. I don't know what I'm doing here either. No, I'm very pleased to be here because the last job I did as a journalist, the last big job, the big story I covered was the Good Friday Agreement in 1997. I stopped working for Tony Blair in 2001, so before he went on to his second term, much more controversial second term with Iraq and all the rest of it. So I felt that my time with Tony Blair was bookended by him, the part he played in bringing one conflict to an end, and the part he played in starting another, even more bloody and more horrific. But I still have a lot of respect for Tony Blair, and one of the things, of course, that people remember about his time in office as Prime Minister, apart from Iraq, and it's always impossible to put Iraq, I sometimes say, look, put Iraq to one side and let's talk about the rest of Tony Blair. It's very hard to ask people to do that because it was such a big and defining aspect of his Prime Ministership. But another defining aspect of his Prime Ministership was his obsession with the media. And it was sometimes described as government by a headline, and in many respects, that was the case. So I'm a loyal kind of guy. I still have a lot of loyalty towards Tony Blair. I still think that government achieved a great deal, but I'm not a Blair head exactly. If we think about Tony Blair in the media, he once said that for politicians to complain about the media was a bit like complaining about the weather. There was really no point. I don't think he meant it for a second. It's a bit like when politicians say they don't read the opinion polls. They're lying. They do read the opinion polls. He didn't mean for a second that there was nothing you could do about the media, that you shouldn't care about the media, that you shouldn't try to influence the media, because we were employed on a day-to-day basis to do exactly that. And he was pretty much obsessed with the media, as are, I'm afraid to say, most prime ministers. The second book I wrote, Denzel kindly mentioned this, The Spin Doctor's Diary, which was an account of my time working there, but the second book was called Where Power Lies, and that book looked back over 100 years, back to when it started off when Lloyd George was Prime Minister during the First World War, at the relationship between Prime Ministers and the media, and where does the power really lie, who wields the power, almost, not without exception, but almost without exception, prime ministers are pretty much obsessed with the media. Now, that quote of Tony Blair's wasn't a particularly original quote, but just because it's a cliche doesn't mean it's not true. Enoch Powell, who was once Ulster Unionist UUP MP for South Down, when that was a possibility, he used to say that for journalists to complain about the media was like the captain of a ship complaining about the waves. It's just something that you had to deal with. And there's no doubt that the media is a huge, huge force in society, so much so that prime ministers, even prime ministers, have to spend a vast amount of their time giving thought to it and working out how to deal with it and working out how to respond to it. Just before he left office, literally in the last few days that he was Prime Minister, Tony Blair made a very big speech about the media, the first one he'd really done about the media, which became known as the Feral Beast speech. And in that speech, he talked about the way in which the media could be like feral beasts, tearing people and reputations to pieces. It was seen to be an attack on the media. It was a flawed speech, flawed so often as his speeches were by a soundbite. He was the master of the soundbite. I mentioned the Good Friday Agreement. No one can forget him standing there at Hillsborough Castle saying, "Today is not the day for soundbites, but I feel the hand of history on my shoulder." He was very good at soundbites when he got them right, as he did over the death of Lady Di, Princess Diana, for example, and on other occasions. They could be very, very effective, but when he got them wrong, they were pretty, pretty terrible. And he spoilt the Feral Beast speech by this reference, actually, to Feral Beast, because it was seen to be simply an attack on journalism. It's a much more thoughtful speech than that, and it's worth going back over. But it does talk about the way in which the media has become so dominant in society so influential in society. And when he was asked afterwards, he did a little press conference afterwards, and he was asked by somebody why he'd made the speech and why, given the fact that he was now talking about the negative impact that journalism could have, the negative impact that the media could have, why then he'd given so much attention to it and put so much effort into it, trying to use the media and persuade the public through the media, and he said, well, because they have power. And I think one of the questions we're trying to address today is, what is that power? How great is that power? And those who feel powerless in that media environment, can they do anything about it? Can they find a way of responding? Can they find a way of using the media as an agent for change, as an agent for progressive change in society, as the whole theme of this conversation is, changing the conversation, or changing some of the conversations that we have as a society and that we have as a community for the good? And I would argue that the media, not only can you not ignore the media in the same way that you can't ignore the waves if you're the captain of a ship, you can use it to good effect. There's a very familiar case, which is that the media are simply a force of conservatism, that they are a barrier to change, that they are sluggish, that they are very slow to respond to developments, that all they're really interested in is conflict, all they're really interested in is perpetuating the divisions in society rather than looking at ways of healing society and all the rest of it. I think it's always a mistake we use the media. I'm never quite sure whether the media is a singular or a plural term, but it should be a plural, because the media is a very, very complex and very varied series of institutions, set of institutions, set of organisations, set of individuals. And so to lump them together and say, the media do this, the media do that, of course, is a mistake. You really can't generalise about them. But for every example that there is, and there are many, where the coverage of the media will frustrate those who believe in progressive change and want to see society improved, there are plenty of examples of where the media has actually been a very, very positive force for change. And if we're talking about the third sector, if we're talking about NGOs and charities and all the rest of it, if you look at the impact of, Live Aid or the coverage of... or comic relief or some of those sort of events, the big telethons, which the newspapers also come in behind, of course that shows them to be a positive force for good. I defer to others on the panel with a much better experience of the way in which the media in Northern Ireland have responded to events over the past 20 years. But certainly, when I was here as a journalist, the papers and the broadcasts were full of bombs, bullets, murders and all the rest of it, and the mayhem of what was so ridiculously termed the Troubles. But I think even then it was fair to say that there was a real sympathy in the media for any kind of cross-community initiatives, integrated education, anything that seemed to try to cross the divides in society in Northern Ireland, got a pretty fair wind in the media, certainly in the BBC. And I would cite the BBC, which is the institution I know best because I worked for it for a long time, as, on the whole, a pretty liberal institution. It's an institution that has no truck with racism or sexism or homophobia. It really does and always has. Obviously, there are examples of where it's gone off the rails, but on the whole, been a force for good in those respects. So I think there are lots of ways in which you can look at the media as being a tool that, if you're clever about it, you can access and use to your advantage. As well as the other bits that I've talked about in terms of the career that I do, I now commentate on these matters, obviously, which is why I'm sitting here. I also run a charity. I'm the executive director of a UK-based charity called the Kaleidoscope Trust, which is a human rights charity, particularly directed towards LGBT rights, gay rights, not in Britain, but abroad. And part of what we try to do is to remind people that we've achieved a huge amount in the UK on gay rights, but actually in many, many parts of the world, there's a huge, huge battle. It's actually getting worse. I won't get on my soapbox on that. That's not what we're here to discuss. But I wanted to... I think LGBT rights is quite a good example. When I was here as a reporter in Northern Ireland, it was actually still illegal to be gay in Northern Ireland. And the Reverend Ian Paisley, among his many other campaigns, was fighting his Save Ulster from Sodomy campaign, which I'm glad to say wasn't successful. But it's still the only part of the United Kingdom that doesn't have same-sex marriage, of course. But that's another issue. But on the whole thing of LGBT rights over those 20 years, the transformation has been enormous. And back in those days, I think probably a lot of gay people would have said that the media was a barrier to change, in that there were stereotypes of gay people in the media that were all sort of limp-wristed queens, and it was all sort of Larry Grayson and that sort of thing. But actually, things have changed a huge amount, and the portrayal of gay people in the media now is completely different. They pop up in soap operas left, right and centre. Very few people, I think, gay people would have much of a complaint about the way in which it has happened. Now, the media weren't at the forefront of that change, but they were an accelerator of change. And once change happened, I think the media played a very positive role in all of that, and actually a vital role in all of that. And one of the key things about the LGBT movement is that visibility in the media. You have to be in there. You have to be up there making your case. And for the people who started off the gay rights movement, that was a very, very difficult, dangerous thing to do. They had to, you know, they had to put themselves up in public through the media, but only through that visibility, only through making the arguments very patiently over time, did social change come about. But the media was a crucial part of that. So you can't expect the media to be an agent of change. Then that's not what they're there for. They're journalists. They are almost all of them. If they're not commercially driven as individuals, they work for companies that are commercially driven in a very difficult and very competitive environment. And you have to think of journalism as a business first and foremost rather than a service to the public, because frankly, I'm afraid that's what it is. A lot of journalists do have ethical beliefs of their own. They are, many of them, very good people. They may very well agree with what it is that you're trying to promote through the media, but that doesn't necessarily mean that they're going to turn it into a story. And that doesn't mean that you're going to get the headlines that you want from them simply because the individual that you're talking to on the phone agrees with you about something. So if you want the media to be an accelerator of change or an agent of change, that requires doing some work. You can't just pick up the phone and say, look, you ought to be running this story because tackling homelessness or drug rehabilitation or whatever else it might be is a good thing, and therefore you should be writing about it because we're doing good things and therefore you should write about it. You have to understand what makes journalists tick. You have to work with them. You have to maybe employ people or find people who may themselves have been journalists or understand journalism in order to find ways in to the media to make it help you in what you do. And if you look at the really big charities, that's exactly what they do. If you look at Greenpeace or Barnardo's or any of those really, really huge charities, Save the Children, you know, they are brilliant at using the media. Some of the human rights charities, Amnesty and Human Rights Watch and all the rest of it, absolutely brilliant at using the media because they understand the media. They recognize that if they frame their arguments in a way that is sympathetic or is accessible to the media, gives them a story. All journalists are interested in is stories. Most of the stories they look for are stories about conflict, about corruption, but they like human interest stories. And if you are able to understand what news is, what fills newspapers, what fills the airwaves, what fills radio, what fills television, then I do believe that it's wrong to take the attitude, which some people in the third sector attempted to do, that the media is just a barrier to everything that we're trying to do. It's not worth the effort. We've got better things to do with our time than trying to persuade them to work for us. I think that's mistaken. I think it can be a hugely, hugely valuable tool. And in order to do that, you have to put yourself in the minds of the journalists, try and work out what makes them tick. And once you've done that, you can start, I hope, to achieve something real and something positive for change, both here in Northern Ireland and more widely.
Okay.